Hi, this is Sedge Thompson. Welcome to this special audio highlights podcast from West Coast Live. For more information about our shows and other guests and podcasts, wcl.org. My next guest on West Coast Live is a renowned biographer. His books on Maxwell Perkins have been and Charles Lindbergh have been awarded with the National Book Award and with the Pulitzer Prize, respectively. He also won a Guggenheim Fellowship for his biography on Goldwyn. He's also written a biography of Kate Hepburn. And he has a book out that's now out in paper on Woodrow Wilson, a biography of that president that most of us probably know very little about. And why is that? We'll find out. Will you please welcome A. Scott Berg to West Coast Live. Thank you very much for coming out.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Does anyone ever tempted to call you the Scott Berg?
A few, but then they start talking to me and they just realize I'm just A. Scott Berg.
But this came about in part because what your mother was a big fan of Scott Fitzgerald.
My mother, in her ninth month of pregnancy, was reading F. Scott Fitzgerald and was determined to give birth to a son and to name that son Scott. And to this day, I'm very grateful she wasn't reading Charlotte Bronte. And and she started with the A's, you know, so I became A. Scott, yeah.
What's the A stand for?
Stands for Andrew, which I've never used.
It opens up the possibility of what Scott Berg means. Scott Berg biography. You had a portrait, a poster. What was it, a campaign poster of Woodrow Wilson on your wall as a kid?
Yeah, but who didn't? You know, I mean, I was 15. I read a book about Woodrow Wilson, and I just fell deeply, truly, madly in love with Wilson. The very same year, actually, that I began to read F. Scott Fitzgerald. So I had this lovely wall of heroes. I also had Adlai Stevenson up there, and I had Don Quixote up there. And there is a through line, which is they are all tragic idealists, all deeply romantic figures. And then it occurred to me one day that three out of the four went to Princeton. Don Quixote did not get in. Very bad board scores. Just didn't get in.
He wanted to come with his sidekick, Sancho. But anyway.
He did, yes. They went to Salamanca instead.
So then you started investigating people's lives, and there's something about choosing the lives that you've have chosen, of the world of publishing, the world of show business, the world of politics here, and also the world of academics in a way. And Woodrow Wilson is an interesting case. I mean, when you take a look at his political career, it was actually rather brief. He was primarily an academic and president of a university, persuaded to be be governor of New Jersey, and then somebody said, hey, why don't you be president, after a very short time.
Exactly right. It boils down to this. Woodrow Wilson enjoyed, if that's the right verb, the most meteoric rise in American history. In October of 1910, this man was the president of a small college in New Jersey, Princeton University. In 1912, he's elected president of the United States. And it will never happen again. It never happened before. And such as it was. And in that interim period, he became an extremely progressive governor of New Jersey. He was handpicked by the machine in New Jersey to be their puppet. And the first thing the puppet did when he got elected was he cut the strings of the puppeteers. And they fell to the ground. And there he was.
He had honed himself on the politics of the academic world.
He truly had. He is, in fact, our most academic, our most intellectual president. He is the most educated. Let me put it that way. I don't want to forget Thomas Jefferson when it comes to intellectuals. But he is the only president to this day to hold a PhD on top of his law degree, on top of his bachelor's degree.
But there was something about his work at the university where he sort of honed political skills. Wasn't there a remark he made that the machine were amateurs compared to the academics he'd had to deal with?
Yes, well, that's exactly right. And Wilson often said the reason he went into public service was to get out of politics. because running a university, he said there's nothing more political than that, as I think we all know to this day, a century later, on any campus. And he proved to be also an extremely effective public thinker during those years that he was in academia, which was most of his adult life. He became one of the great orators in the country, and in fact, by the time he was president, I think he was the greatest orator of the day. So that combination of this great mind with this great ability to speak and a great ability to write. I mean, this is a president. You know, we've had some who haven't read 12 books. This is one who wrote 12 books. There he was. So he was quite a remarkable figure.
How was one an orator in those days? What was the means that a candidate was heard? How did he get his voice and his platform out in such a short time?
One whistle stop at a time is the answer. And there are recordings, but this was, of course, pre-radio. And so one had to go hear Woodrow Wilson. And one did. The interesting thing about Wilson, and I think this was one of the secrets to his great success, he introduced a new kind of oratory. Even if you look at old film clips of, say, Teddy Roosevelt or William Jennings Bryan, you know, you'll see them poking the heavens and thunderous. You can't hear their voices, but you know how it's coming out. Wilson was kind of the first modern orator. He spoke person to person. He used very heightened language. He never cheapened his vocabulary for the audience. And this, in turn, proved to be extremely effective because even the most common man could listen to Professor Wilson and say, I understand what he's saying. I feel uplifted by this man. And I think this proved to be very beneficial.
How did his first term in office go?
The first term in office, I believe, is the advancement of the greatest progressive agenda that any president has ever put across. He did this in two ways. First of all, he came in with an extremely well thought out progressive agenda. The second is Wilson changed the way presidents functioned. Woodrow Wilson was the first and almost the last president to have a genuine ongoing dialogue with the Congress. This is a crazy concept, but Woodrow Wilson was a political scientist by nature and by study. And as a result of this, he had this crazy concept about American government. He believed the two main branches, the executive branch and the legislative branch, the White House and the Congress. Get ready, go with me on this. He believed these two branches should cooperate. And I mean this quite literally. He meant they should co-operate the government. And that involved a constant dialogue. And so Wilson used to go to the Congress sometimes five times a week and sit in an office that sits right off the Senate floor, which presidents just don't use. They don't even know about it. And I think part of the reason they don't know about it is it has a very exotic name. This office is called the President's Room.
Who would know? I mean, but he also, he wanted to be kind of like prime minister rather than president of a parliamentary system.
Well, he did. Being a great student of governments, he did want to be prime minister, and he felt the American system, while he loved America with all every fiber, he did feel the American system was a little screwy because it made for the possibility of an adversarial relationship between a Congress and a president. And shouldn't it be that a president could come in with an agenda and pass it until the public says no more? And he did have this great advantage in his first term. He had a heavily Democratic Congress, and he was able to pass, well, he got the tariffs lowered. He introduced the modern income tax with a graduated tax rate. He started something we call the Federal Reserve System. So basically, Woodrow Wilson defined the American economy for the next 100 years. He put the first Jew, Louis Brandeis, on the Supreme Court. So this was the first major shattering of a glass ceiling at the federal level. And the 40-hour work week, child labor laws, I mean, it just didn't stop. It was just a juggernaut.
And yet he had cabinet members who segregated the U.S. Government and allowed sort of a Jim Crow policy to take hold.
And there is the flip side, and one has to remember this too. Woodrow Wilson was a Southerner by birth. and by upbringing. This is a boy who remembered the Civil War. He remembered Reconstruction. He grew up in the very segregated South. Wilson was more enlightened than most of his kinsmen. He was constantly aware of the plight, the role of the African American in American society. He had it in his mind to integrate the two, but he truly felt in his heart of hearts that the country simply wasn't ready for it in 1913. And as a result of that, and as a result of being truly beholden to the Southern bloc in the Congress, if he wanted that great legislative program passed, he went along with the introduction of Jim Crow in Washington, D.C., which in essence, you know, Woodrow Wilson didn't invent segregation, but he basically codified it for certainly the next half century, which is exactly what Wilson thought it would take before the country was ready to get rid of it.
When you were looking into his life, what did you find was the role of his wives and other women around him?
Yes, and we should hasten to add he had only one wife at a time. that being said, I think the great surprise for readers, and it was even a surprise for me who had been reading about Woodrow Wilson most of my life, is how deeply passionate this man was. This was a true romantic. When he courted his first wife, who was a Presbyterian minister's daughter, he being a Presbyterian minister's son, whom he had met in Georgia, they engaged in a correspondence that is the most romantic love correspondence I've ever read. I mean, there are literally thousands of letters between these two people that are, they're passionate, they're sexual, they're intellectual, they're emotional, they share everything. And there it all is. It's quite wonderful. The great tragedy was that a year and a half in office in the White House, this beloved woman died. And the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, is now utterly bereft. He doesn't know how he can go on. He talks about resigning from the White House. And the only thing that really got him to go on, well, two things. The first was that very week, World War I broke out, and good Presbyterian duty insisted he get out of bed. And the second is, after a few months, wouldn't you know it, he met a very attractive young widow in Washington, D.C. He courted her with thousands of the most passionate love letters you've ever read.
And while dealing with World War I.
While dealing with, yes, World War I on one hand and writing love letters on the other hand. And actually, the two come into play. There are days, as you can see in the book, where Wilson is giving speeches, and he's so madly in love with this woman, he doesn't even know what he's saying. And there are one or two rather ridiculous speeches he gave before we got into the war. Because, and at the end of it, he said to the woman he did marry, "I don't even know what I said."
That's kind of frightening. But we have had presidents since that perhaps also fit that quality. You quote what Taft said on leaving office when Woodrow Wilson went in, that I'm really glad to get out of here. This is the loneliest place, the loneliest job in the world. Did Wilson find it that way?
Wilson definitely found it that way, as I think virtually every president does. It is, and increasingly so, I think, a thankless job. This country, the beauty of it is how splintered we are, but as a result of that, no matter what you stand for, you know, the sun rising, there's somebody against it. And Wilson encountered that in a very controversial time, because with the World War breaking out, with progressivism running rampant, largely because he's pushing it to do so, Woodrow Wilson is really ushering this country into a whole new century and really creating new ideas that had to be dealt with. And of course, people are naturally resistant to new ideas.
Many people know him for the League of Nations and attempts to kind of put together a peaceful world as the result of the conflict of World War I. Yet he ran into sort of the real politic of European, of the British, of the French, of the Germans, of, you know, in many ways sort of overwhelmed. It was perhaps even more difficult than dealing with the Congress How did he fare? What was his vision for the world at the time? And then what was the... It took a toll on him, too.
It took a terrible toll. In fact, it really cost him his life. Woodrow Wilson ultimately, after keeping us out of World War I for several years, ultimately felt we had to get into it. Woodrow Wilson in 1917 delivered a speech to a joint session of Congress in which he called for a declaration of war. In that speech is a single sentence that has become the bedrock of all American foreign policy for the last century, and that is, the world must be made safe for democracy. Now, with that moral component for the first time added to foreign policy, that has opened the doors, you see, for every possible incursion of the last century. Now, the reason I think Wilson opened this Pandora's box was he believed if we could get into that war, if we won that war, which we did, then he could write the peace. And in so doing, Wilson had 14 ideas for the peace. He called them points. And the 14th point was the creation of a League of Nations, which was this incredibly idealistic, but he thought realistic notion that every country could sign on to sit down at a great Arthurian-like table and discuss peace before you would ever go to war. And there would be the notion of collective security, that if ever a country broke this peace, you faced not one country, you faced everybody at the table. It was a wonderful idea. He got it across. He got all the people in Paris at the peace talks to put it into the treaty. There it was. The greater realpolitik he found was at home, when he got home to an increasingly hostile and Republican Congress. And that was his demise, trying to put it over.
But he was also unwilling to compromise with the Congress in some way, which led to the demise. He also ended up having a series of strokes that affected his mental capabilities, and for the last year and a half, he didn't leave his White House bedroom?
Correct. This is, I think, one of the most dramatic stories in American history, and I think it is the greatest conspiracy in American history, which is Woodrow Wilson came back from Paris to promote his League of Nations. When he realized the Senate was not going to ratify the treaty with the League, he decided to do an end run, take it to the people. He engaged on a 29-city tour around the country in the very hot summer of 1919. Halfway through the tour, he collapsed, they rushed him home, and he suffered a major stroke. And here's where the great conspiracy begins, because the second Mrs. Wilson and a handful of doctors decided to keep from the world the fact that the President of the United States had suffered a stroke. And for the last year and a half of the Woodrow Wilson administration, nobody saw the President, no document got before him, no piece of paper got a signature unless it passed first through Mrs. Wilson. So I say, remember the name Edith Bowling Galt Wilson, because for all intents and purposes, she was the first female president of the United States. She ran the executive branch.
We're talking with A. Scott Berg, and his latest biography is on Woodrow Wilson. You grew up in a Hollywood household. Your father was a renowned film and television producer. He developed sort of the format of the movie of the week for television. Sitting around the dinner table, did you learn how to tell stories from there? Is that part of what your interest in storytelling is?
I think so, yes, and I could do it in 22 minutes with commercials, too. We were a chatty family, and we were all into books, movies, and politics. So, but yes, I think it was the coin of the realm at our dinner table was to tell a good story, and you could hold the floor as long as you were engaging.
I was interested to read about your father that he didn't, as a producer, he never wanted actors at his house except for just one. I mean, what was it about actors?
Oh, do you have to ask? As Zero Mostel says of the producers, have you ever seen them eat? I mean, you know. So there's that. But it was, I think, my father and my mother, who had a very long Hollywood marriage until my father's fairly recent death. I think they realized that actors, you couldn't always believe them. You couldn't take it to the bank. And so... writers, directors, they had more clout, more importance in our household. And I think there was just something a little too flighty about actors. And so my parents really didn't want to expose us to too many of them. And I think the great fear was that one of us might become one.
But none of you did, but all of you are in the sort of the show business. Did your father ever talk to you about whether one of your books would make a good movie of the week?
Actually, my father talked about it all the time. And it's quite strange because at this very moment, a number of the books are all being developed. The Wilson book, Leonardo DiCaprio's company, is now developing as a film. My Lindbergh project, which Steven Spielberg originally bought the rights to make a feature film, and my father said, well, that's great, it's Spielberg, but it really should be a miniseries. And because then you could tell the whole story. And in fact, it is now 15 years later, being developed as a miniseries at Paramount. And my Max Perkins book, a book about a book editor and his relationships with Thomas Wolfe and F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway, starts filming in 3 weeks with Colin Firth playing Maxwell Perkins and Jude Law playing Thomas Wolfe. And we have a wonderful cast with Laura Linney and Nicole Kidman and Guy Pearce. And it's going to be a wonderful film, I think.
Excellent. Well, Wilson. DiCaprio is Wilson. Can you see that?
I can. I don't know that I want to have dinner with him, but I can see it.
The book is called Wilson, A. Scott Berg. Thank you very much for being on West Coast. I'm glad to have you here. This is Edge Thompson. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Try out others from West Coast Live right here, and we look forward to having you in one of our audiences one day. For more information, wcl.org.